The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 45 from the Blue Cliff Record. Zhaozhou's 7-pound cloth robe. A monk asked Zhaozhou, "The 10,000 dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to?" Zhaozhou said, "When I was in Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds." In Secho's verse, "You brought a piece of logic to trap the old gimlet, but do you know the meaning of the 7-pound cloth robe? Now I have thrown it away into Lake Seiko and sail before the wind. Who will share the coolness with me?" So our great ancestor Zhaozhou lived in 9th century China in the Tang Dynasty, the so-called golden era of Zen. Of course, people in the golden era didn't know they were living in the golden era. They thought they were just practicing and trying to get by. But 200 or so years later in the Sung Dynasty, they decided, oh, those people really had it. That was the golden era. So it is. This moment is only this moment, and when we taste it most deeply, in some way we can say it is flavorless. All of the opinion, these are the good old days, or it's so difficult, all of this arises after the fact, after the immediacy of the experience. But anyway, these are known as the golden age of Zen, and Zhaozhou, many stories about him. He was clearly some kind of great and charismatic figure, and in numerous stories in the Koan collection, the collections that we use, he appears. He is the one, very first number one in Gateless Gate, "Does a dog have Buddha nature?" And he says, "Mu." He says, "No." An eloquent sermon that has puzzled us adherents for many, many generations now. He also, in case 37 in the Gateless Gate, he was asked by a student, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West?" Maybe student saying, if we all have Buddha nature already, what's all the fuss? Why did Bodhidharma make the great voyage to come to China?" And Zhaozhou said, "The oak tree in the garden." A teacher of a few words, and a teacher that is known for pointing in some way that is often seen as indirect. He often seems to avoid the matter. But when we look more closely, we can perhaps see some kind of direct pointing. And so in this case, the monk asked Zhaozhou, "The 10,000 dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to?" And this is a reference, as I was looking into this over the past few days, to the Gandharuya Sutra, where it says, "All things of the three realms are reduced to one mind." All things of the three realms are reduced to one mind. And that sutra was written 200 years after the Buddha's death, and apparently his words, three realms, past, present, and future, where do they return to? He says, the one mind. Centuries later, Hungjur writes, the Dharma realms in the ten directions arise from the single mind. Dharma realms in the ten directions. Dharma has many meanings. One meaning is the teaching, the teachings. But dharmas are also things, the things of this world, the things of our life. In the ten directions arise from the single mind. This single mind, single heart, the one, this vast boundlessness. Earlier we recited James Ford's rendition of the Heart Sutra, where he wrote so eloquently about this boundlessness, about all things are nothing but this boundlessness. And in Zen we look quite deeply into, sometimes we say the one and the many. Sometimes we say form and emptiness. But pointing to different aspects of our experience. So the 10,000 dharmas return to one, where does the one return to? Is what the monk asked Zhao Zhou. And in these koans, we're invited to enter into all of the positions of the koan. These koans, little dramas, little stories. And as we work with them and study, most helpful to study from the inside out, right? This Zen teaching, again and again we say, this is not about learning something outside you that you don't know. This is about touching something that is already here. And so the monk, you and me, who is he? What's going on for this monk? The 10,000 dharmas return to the one. Where does the one return to? So as I dream into him, I imagine that he is like you and me, coming with some genuine sincerity. Was speaking with my daughter recently, and she's reading a new parenting book that she likes a lot. And I said, well, what's some of the wisdom from this book? And she said, well, one thing it says is to treat your child's behavior with the most generous interpretation possible, and things will go better for you. And we both thought that that might be a good thing to do to all people, to interpret their actions in the most generous light possible. Because, of course, what we react to with each other is not so much what's really going on, because we don't know what's really going on. We don't know what's really going on with another person. We don't even know what's really going on with us. Moment after moment, something arises. Some thought, some opinion, some judgment, some feeling, some sensation. And it is truly arising in the moment. And then we, in our wonderful human way, make a story out of it. Oh, that sound, whoosh. Oh, that's the cars on Pleasant Street. I know what that is. I know where I am. And as we practice our Zen, we are trying to move closer and closer to the thing itself. And the thing, of course, is life, and life only and always manifesting as this and that. And as we move closer to the whoosh, as we move closer to the sensation in the knee, as we move closer to the feeling in the heart, this field of experience, the mind state that we are in right now, maybe for you quite excited and present here in the this lovely spring morning sun flooding into the Zendo, maybe feeling quite energized to be here, or maybe not, maybe wondering why you decided this would be a good idea. Wouldn't it be so nice to be outside walking, and here we are listening to this guy blab on and on and on, and what is he saying and what am I doing? This mind state arises too. And the wonderful thing about Zen is that we don't have to make anything up, and we don't have to stop anything. We did read the first two parts of the Heart in True and Heart of True and Trusting verses of the Faith Mind, it's sometimes called, but it talks about how much trouble we cause trying to stop our thoughts. Some thought arises, and then some part of me rises up and says, this is not what I should be feeling. I should be calm and spacious. I should be more energized. I shouldn't be so buzzy. I shouldn't be so anxious. Opinion comes immediately, and opinion is not a problem. It just arises. It's actually the second foundation of mindfulness, the Vedanas, is noticing that with every mind moment has a kind of valence to it, that some are positive, kind of like this, moving upward. Some are negative, pushing away, don't like, and some are neutral. And the instructions in the foundations of mindfulness are not about trying to change this, but rather to appreciate this. And maybe this is the basic movement of our Zen practice, to move from the mind of changing, to move from the mind of better and worse to the mind of appreciating. Of course, it's no small matter to appreciate this human life. The 10,000 joys and sorrows arise, and it's not simply a matter of hoping or thinking that you can avoid the worst of it. There is no avoiding the worst of it, except as we begin to see that the worst of it is not the worst of it. The worst of it, those dark places, those contracted places, are not what you think they are. Your opinion of how you're doing is nothing more than a thought floating in the mind, some neurons connecting and saying good, bad. And we can notice this, and as we appreciate even the one who judges, the one who may be critical of yourself and how you're doing, the one who may be critical of the people sitting next to you and across from you. Wonderful to practice together because the opportunity for irritation arises. Of course, I myself am never irritated. of course, I am, day after day, moment after moment, and quite embarrassing to have practiced Zen for as long as I have and still be irritated by how the dishes are placed on the counter. But yet there it is, isn't it? There it is, and the possibility of our practice is to let it be there. So irritation arises, and we, of course, become the Buddha of irritation. And nothing needs to be done, nothing needs to be fixed. The problem is not the problem. The problem is entry point, right? Dharma gates are boundless. This moment, this arising. There's some schools of thought that say in life there are windows of opportunity, and you need to watch carefully, and when a window of opportunity comes, then leap through the window, almost like you could escape from your life. I'll leap through this window of opportunity, and then I won't have to be me anymore. I can be someone else. But in Zen, we say that every moment is the window of opportunity. I think it was Alan, it might have been Michael, might have been someone else, who knows who says what, but I think it was Alan last night who said, all of your life has led you to this moment. Of course, we look back on our lives and we sort, this was a good time, this was a bad time. And certainly there are moments of ease and delight, and there are moments of great pain and difficulty, but our practice is to appreciate them all, because all of them were exactly necessary. All of them have led exactly to this point where everything is available to you. Zen is quite wonderful because you can practice it for a lifetime and still be a beginner. And the beginning is equal to the end. The golden Buddha statue is golden from the soles of the feet up to the top of the top knot. Your golden life is fully golden each moment, each breath. I do believe that to have some intention and to give ourself fully is required, that some great effort is required to see into this great matter. The momentum of our lives is so fierce that unless you really gather yourself together, and unless it's really important to you, not just, well, it'd be kind of interesting to know what life is about, but I think I'll go watch another basketball game. No, unless it is becomes the center in some way. Putting this at the center, of course, has all kinds of different forms. For those of us here, in the Zendo this morning, the form is on Sesshin. For those who may listen to this talk at some other time, the form is whatever it is you are doing at this moment. But some clear intention and some work over time, there is a gradual process that happens. Of course, there are insights that arise moment after moment, teeny tiny insights. Sometimes these little moments of awakening are so brief and ephemeral, we hardly notice. We're on to the next problem, but Other times something shifts and we have a sense of relief or ease. We can have this sense of, maybe I am okay. Maybe life is not the story I've been telling. Maybe life is life. And this is wondrous, and we can be touched so deeply, or just so lightly, just the faintest breeze on the cheek. However it is, there are these moments of awakening for all of us. And there is the gradual work of Zen. Hongzhi says you must purify, cure, grind down, or brush away all the tendencies you have fabricated into apparent habits. You must purify, grind down, brush away. There is work to be done. Breathe in, breathe out, wander away 1,000 times, come back 1,000 times. There is no end to this path. So this is the wonderful truth of all of us are beginners each time. Now for me, breath practice 40 years and still breathe in and breathe out. Still the belly swells. And then as the air goes out, the belly falls back. And I do my best to appreciate this life. This life in all of its particulars. And so imagining this monk, he has tasted the one of these moments, or maybe many of these moments, when the 10,000 dharmas return to the one. He is not talking about something you don't know. 10,000 dharmas return to the one is your busy mind suddenly is no longer front and center, but it is your breath front and center, or chopping, cutting up the bananas for breakfast. Whatever it is in the moment, when there is just hearing, when there is just seeing, and the moment of life, the everyday moments at the checkout, at the grocery store, a moment of noticing this cashier, a human being, me, human being, here we are for this brief moment, never to know more about each other, and sometimes in those moments too can be a sweetness and an intimacy. When we are fully present in the moment, there is only this moment, this one heart engaged here, this one heart that is not the heart that you imagine is separate from the world. This is the heart of the world, touching and being touched. Subject and object. Subject, the one who sees, the seeing, the hearing, the tasting, the object, that which is seen and heard and tasted. These are not two. And we close the gap. And when it is clear, when it is clear and simple, when we appreciate the feeling of the floor on the soles of our feet, when we appreciate the ache in our shoulders, then there are not two. Everything returns to the one. And so these moments of full presence, we might say, full presence, Hongzhi said, when the mind is still, we might say when the mind is fully present, all appearances are entirely exhausted. Which is over there? Which one is myself? So these moments when it's not clear who's who, and the breathing of your belly and the breathing of your neighbor, no difference. We are simply present in the fullness of whatever is here, and we see clearly. So imagining this is what the monk, he has tasted this. But then he goes on. So maybe just that first part would have been a lovely report. This is what I have noticed, that all of the 10,000 joys and sorrows are present in this moment as I sit here. Nothing is outside me, nothing is inside me. Outside world is unlimited, inside world is unlimited. And in this field of fullness, there is just the particular and the one, no separation. But this monk decides to improve on it a little bit, perhaps, as we are wont to do. Something arises, and so he says, where does the one return to? The 10,000 dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to? Secho, who makes the comment, he imagines that this monk is trying to trap the old master. The monk has gone from reporting on his experience to the fullness of life as one, gone into then on the mind road. He has sort of made his experience into a thing and then is playing with this thing in his mind. One commentator, one Zen teacher said, this monk is one of those whose view is hardened at the point of radiant awareness. This monk is one of those whose view is hardened at the point of radiant awareness. So this point of radiant awareness, these moments of sparkle, these moments of ease. Please do not imagine that I'm talking about other people who are further along than you. I am talking to you, to your life and your experience. And there are moments where some kind of something shifts and you are touched, some moment when you surrender, not because you've been told it's a good idea to surrender, but maybe you're too tired and too fed up to do what you usually do. And so maybe just for part of a moment, you relax and accept your place in the world, in this radiant world of life. So we have these moments, little or big, and then we so easily harden at the point of radiant awareness. We make it into a story. We make it into a, okay, I've got something. I better do something with it. So he asked this question. The 10,000 dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to? Jiaozhou, in my mind, so wonderfully and kindly, he doesn't yell at the student and say, just stop making it about your mind. Will you give up on that? He doesn't reprimand him at all. And he doesn't fall into the trap of trying to explain. Of course, so many questions arise, and we ask these questions, and part of the job of anyone playing the teacher role is to avoid the trap of it's kind of the sucker pitch. It looks like it's going right down the center of the plate and you swing and it's nowhere to be found. So let me go on for on and on about where does the one return to? Well, it returns to emptiness. And let me tell you a thing or two about emptiness, because I've thought a lot about it. Jiaozhou does not go here. He says, when I was in Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. Jiaozhou expounds the Dharma, the deep discourse of the Dharma, the heart of the Dharma is exposed here, is offered, kindly offered in the vividness and in the particularness. He doesn't fly off into religion or spirituality. He doesn't go into explanations, but points to the thing itself, this 7 pound cloth robe, traditionally 7 pounds of flax is what it required to make a robe for a monk. And he made a robe. You have made a robe of your life. Right? And it is the shape of your job, the shape of your family, the shape of the rhythms of your life. This is your 7 pound robe that you have made. The point is not to forget everything, but the point is to be present. Feel the weight of your robe, the shape of your life, the shape of your heart, mind in this moment. As, of course, we all sit with all of our friends and family, all of our friends and all of the people who make our lives difficult, often the very same people. We sit with all of them. These are the shape of this is the shape of our lives in this moment. And so this 7 pound, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. So where do we look? How do we find our way? And this koan story offering both an appreciation of these moments of delight might be too strong a word, but moments of ease, and to be fully one with the breath, be fully one with the walking. When the bell rings, come, go, stand, sit. Bow, don't bow. When someone pulls you aside to give you a correction, noticing what arises and appreciating, appreciating all of the things that arise, appreciating this one fragile and precious life here, and noticing the stories, noticing the answers we want. Noticing how we might want it to be different, or we want to make sure it keeps going like it's been going. And Jiaozhou's wonderful. When I was in Qingzhou, I made a cloth robe. It weighed 7 pounds. Thank you. So let's have our servers move around and sit comfortably, please, facing this way. So, opportunity for Dharma dialogue to come forward with the shape of your robe, your heart mind. Yeah, Bix.
Yeah, this way is so annoyingly, frustratingly simple. Where it's like, what's been coming up for me a lot recently is it's, I thought that there was going to be like something else, but it's not. and that's just like, it's like annoying.
Yeah, sorry about that. I appreciate you saying that because I think we all come. We think there's some secret formula and maybe they'll be clear enough to actually tell me what it is. And you sit around long enough to see that it is so simple and so obvious that you knew all the time. And yet... we have to come and do this work to be able to reach that that we already have. Yeah, thanks, Bix. Yeah, Matt.
Thank you for the talk, David. I was really deeply touched by it, and I felt like it, you know, spoke to me very deeply, which is to say, my mind was going all over the place. I was in, I was out, I was with you, I was formulating a response, I was not, the 10,000 things, the one thing, you know, it's maybe I'm saying some of what Bix was saying, it's just kind of, that roiling is, it can be frustrating, and then there's a moment of like, oh, yeah, just that. I don't know what else to say.
You're describing something like trying to catch that sunlight coming through the window.
Yeah.
Right? You can't, but you can just sit in the sunlight.
Yeah, and it's simple and it's complicated at the same time, yeah. You know, and you're giving us the other side, the ways that our minds twist and turn. And, you know, we read the Heart Sutra a little while ago. I the first time I read it, I didn't say, wow, that's so simple. Finally, somebody just comes out and says it. In some ways, we need to go through those waves of exhaustion, of mental exhaustion, to then appreciate the simplicity, and then we slide back into all that activity.
It's like, you know, I say roiling. It's like there's glints, like constant. You know, it's just it's light, it's dark, it's light, it's dark.
And in some ways, the part of the skill is to hold our hands open, yeah. Right? Because we think, okay, that's it, right? Yeah. no, that's it. And so the glints come, and Whitman has a wonderful line, I think in Leaves of Grass, where he says, I find letters from God everywhere, and I leave them right where they are because I know they will come forever. Right, so the shell on the beach, I think, well, I better read that inside. That's the one I've got to keep, right? And so we let them come and go, trusting. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, Madhu.
So as you were talking, I was thinking about this, you know, problem that I have sometimes. So when I think about my life and how, you know, I handle things, it's so hard for me to kind of like, you know, exactly say my mind state and, you know, to categorize it like in words. It's very hard. And I feel like that's what the world expects from me, right? Mm. To know where I stand at a relative level. Mm. And so that difficulty is something that I've struggled with. So you have this tendency to turn away from that and not, you know, not being able to and feeling like I can't express myself, you know, all the time. So I don't know why your talk, but it just came to me that, you know, also I need to understand my mind at the level of words. At least, you know, it's not possible, but even if it's approximate or close to it, you know, just so that I can, you know, just this, for sake of some transparency or some, you know, being at the same level with the world and people around me, it is so important.
Interesting. Of course, we can't actually describe what's going on in anything we say. First of all, it's about what we were feeling the moment before, so it doesn't really apply. And then our language makes it sound like there is one thing. Are you sad? Are you happy? Well, I'm happy sad, and all of these things. And so we use language in ways, and it, you know, is quite helpful in the grocery store and at work, and people do expect us to talk. And so how to do that skillfully. Maybe the wonderful thing about here on retreat is you don't have to know what's going on. And certainly any words as you're sitting, I know sometimes when I'm not feeling well, I catch myself saying, I'm sick, I'm sick, I'm sick, I'm sick. And I think that's probably not helpful for me over the course of the day, but I kind of noticed that I'm trying to do exactly what you're saying. I'm trying to say, all right, you know, this is what it is. And so here on Sesshin, you don't have to know, and you don't have to put any labels on. In fact, any labels you put, you can let them fly away, right? And then we can sit and find our home in this place of not knowing, because that's the other aspect of what I hear you saying. I don't know. And this is one of the places that's really okay. You know, there may be pressure, you know, other people, you go home and they'll say this or that. But here, allow yourself not to have to know and find some freedom and practice this. Yeah. Thanks.
As David was talking, I was thinking about, I was previewing in my mind one of our re-entry suggestions, which is not to try to talk to other people about Sesshin, because, you know, it's a fall out of that grace that David was just talking about.
Yeah, and this is exactly what struggling with trying to express yourself looks like. That's it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ray.
Thank you, David. When the thing that struck me about your talk was we're talking about the secular age of Joshu, and that 9th century was the golden age.
Oh, yeah.
Zen. And I thought, this moment is the golden age. That right now, whatever we're experiencing is just the right thing for us to be experienced. We couldn't ask for, well, we could want different things, but what we're receiving now is just the right thing for us to experience. This golden age that is manifesting now in this moment.
And it reminds me of the story I've told many times about my teacher, George Bowman, when he was a young student sitting with Sun Sanim, the great Korean Zen master, and they were trying to start a sangha in Providence, and they were having a retreat. They had one retreat a month, and they'd just gotten these robes from Korea, but they were winter robes, and it was the summer. So he and Sun Sanim were sitting on the front step on a Friday afternoon in this kind of rundown section of Providence, and no one was showing up to their retreat. And Sun Sanim looked over at George and he said, "Georgie, these are the good old days." Right? So exactly what you're saying, right? Yeah, the golden years right here. Yeah, Anne.
Yeah, sometimes, dare I say it, Dokusan is the time you have to say something and you can't. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes even when I'm sitting, I think, God, what if they called me a Dokusan right now? What do I say? And it like shatters the whole thing. It just stops.
Yeah, there is a way in Dokusan that we turn the heat up a little bit. And actually, we really do that to clarify. And sometimes the answer is, I have no idea, right? I present myself, I don't know who I am or what question I have, or and I'll say, so how is it for you right now? And sometimes the answer is clear. It's like this, it's like that. And sometimes it's all unclear. And so there can be a clear answer of confusion, a clear answer of, I don't know, right? And also, when we're in Dokusan, only part of the interaction, apparently this is true of all human conversation, but a very small percentage is the words we say. That we are being together in Dokusan, and it is about some kind of meeting at the deepest level that happens whether we're aware of it or not. But when you come in the door, you've already told me your story, right? And you sit down. Not in some, like, I can read your mind kind of way, but when we walk exactly as we are. We can walk confused, we can walk confident, we can walk fallen apart. Happens at so many levels.
There's the option too, and I think it'll be mentioned in the Dokusan instructions today, which is, you know, it goes, or to just be with the teacher. And almost no one takes that one up. It's interesting, you know, but it can be powerful. I'm not encouraging you all to do that for everybody.
Right? And no one said a word.
But just to sit with the teacher, that's always one of many options.
Yeah. Thanks. And maybe last one, Deb.
Thanks so much. one of the phrases that popped up for me when you said, I dreamt into this koan, I think something like that.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, that's another way to sit. It's like, not so much like, oh, I'm going to figure this out, but like dreaming. Am I dreaming? Or am I just being with what is? And anyway, I just... That phrase touched me.
There, you know, of course, we say this life is a dream, right? And who's dreaming whom and all of that. But I think there is a quality that you're bringing out of not operating from central headquarters, right? Central headquarters is like, okay, I'm going to figure this out, and I know, I've listened to the instruction, I know, much more relying on something else. Of course, we are carried by life itself, by the winds of the spirit of the universe, the molecules, the cells, everything. So maybe dreaming is a little bit trusting more of what is arising, trusting it's not about knowing, it's about, just this. Yeah. So let's stop there, let's restore the Zendo and continue our practice.